This program is a paid presentation for American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC, and is brought to you by American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC. The opinions expressed on the program by the host, host guest, and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not represent the opinions of management of this station or Brazos Communications West, LLC, who bear no responsibility or liability for the program's content. The purpose of this radio program is intended to inform the public on financial planning issues and investment products for qualified individuals and investors. Many of the topics and opinions discussed may be of a personal nature, and some people may disagree with or find opinions expressed on this program objectionable. Before you invest, you should consult with financial advisors and review the program prospectus and its risks.
97 Gold presents Your Money with Fay Bagby. Sound advice to help your money grow. Now, here's Fay Bagby on 97 Gold.
Good morning.
Good morning, Fay. How are you?
Well, it's a beautiful day. Beautiful.
Every Saturday morning is a beautiful day.
You know, it is. But I love it when it gets a little cooler like it is now. Just a little cooler, a little wind, that's just fine.
That's all it takes. You know, you get a little bit of hope, because when we finally break that summertime desert heat, it's almost like breaking a fever. And then when we start getting nightly lows into the 60s, that's when things really start to turn around. We had a couple of days in the upper 80s this past week. And so it is really, I tell you, when it comes to the seasons changing, I don't always look at the daytime temperatures. I look at the nighttime temperatures. And when the nighttime lows start going from like 80 down to 70 and into the upper 60s, then you know that fall is almost here. And so it's been that way, and that's a good sign.
Well, and I have a tree that's trying to turn already.
Really?
That tree shouldn't be turning, but it is.
Well, that seems awfully early.
I think so. I think maybe it's lack of water. Maybe we better be watering it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about, that it just needs watering.
Well, that might be too. I mean, sometimes when it gets real dry, that'll make a tree turn colors too.
Okay, that might be it. Well, I'm glad. Thank you, doctor. I appreciate that.
Do not take gardening tips from me. Good Lord, that's the worst thing you could do ever.
Oh, my gosh. Well, water, I figured it was safe, you know.
No!
Oh, my gosh. You can't even do it right on watering. Well, that's too bad.
I know. And here's another sign of fall. And I know this is really stretching it, but I think we're like about 6 or 7 weeks away, maybe 6 weeks, from the time change. And so then it'll be dark at 3 p.m.
Oh, I wish you hadn't even mentioned that thing again. You know, that is so sad when it's dark, you know, so early.
No.
And in the summer, it's in 9 o'clock, and I love that part. And, you know, some people are talking about making that permanent.
Yes.
I saw that. Yeah, they think they might should make it permanent.
Which one? Because I did hear that they were talking about, but I can't remember which one they want to make permanent. Is it the one where it's dark really early, or the one
No. Where it's daylight till 9 o'clock forever.
Oh, okay.
The rest of our lives.
Yes, yes.
And because people want to do so much outside, and it gets dark so early, they just, you know, they don't like that, especially in the winter.
Yes. Yeah, you go into hibernation for like 6 months.
That's right. And you know, when you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and it's solid, dark, you know, it's tough.
It is. It makes you feel like you're up in the middle of the night, and your body clock gets a little off whack.
That's right. And it's bad enough being cold in the winter, but I'd like for it to get up when it's daylight.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my thought.
That would be nice.
It would be very nice. Well, let's just give out the phone number.
Let's do that, please.
Okay. It's 877-588-3330. It's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring, right next to Ivy Cottage, on the main street of America.
Did you just make that up right then and there?
I made it up this morning.
Wow. This is Your Money with Fay Bagby, and this is all about growing your money so that you can retire happy, wealthy, and early. And what do you tell the people who say, no, Fay, I love working. I don't really plan on retirement. What do you tell those people? What's the plan at that point for that type of person who plans on working forever?
Well, if they plan to work forever, let's invest forever, and you'll be in great shape. If you're not ever going to retire, can you imagine your retirement, how much it's going to be?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to be still be working at 75. Well, that's okay. We'll just keep investing that money and racking up that interest, putting that interest in there, and you're going to be in great shape. You're not going to be like the rest of us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Well, you know, do I have enough to retire? And people are asking themselves that question because it costs so much more to live.
Mm-hmm, it does.
You know, I mean, if you think back years ago, I was thinking about this the other day. In the 50s and 60s, remember what a car cost?
Oh, golly. About,
you know, $3,000 or $4,000.
Yeah, it was nothing.
And a house, you could buy a house for $6,000.
Exactly.
And look where we are nowadays. A house is $300,000 just for a regular house.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw the other day where in 1918, these people came out to Midland and bought all this land for $1.18
wow.
an acre. Their estate, they say, is now worth $7
billion. Oh, my goodness.
$7
billion. Holy smokes. Now, even back then, you know, a dollar and something was a pretty good chunk of change back then. But boy, howdy, to be, you know, in the billions from that, wow, that's amazing.
And their story is that everybody has drilled everywhere else. They allow some drilling, no horizontal, regular drilling, and they own every bit of the minerals.
Really?
How about that?
Wow.
100% minerals, folks.
How about that?
Can you believe if we owned some minerals?
Oh, geez.
Oh, yeah.
We could retire before lunch right now.
And now they tell me there is a huge, huge, huge strike between New Mexico and down past Pecos going south, that it's going to be even bigger than the one between Midland and Lubbock.
Are you serious? They found another one?
Another one. And the reason I know, my son has a friend that owns some of that land. And they've been out to him three times, and the price just goes up and up and up what they offered him.
Wow.
And he said, wait a minute. I need to check this out. Why are they offering so much? You know, and he found out the reason is they've got this huge strike that they say is going to be the biggest in the world. And I don't know if that's true. I always take everything with a grain of salt. But they say it is huge, and people are going to make a fortune down there.
Wow. Now, I thought that they were saying that the previous one that they had found was going to be the biggest one ever. It'll outlast all of our lifetimes, be around for 100 years and all that. And so this one's going to be even bigger?
That's what he told us.
Wow.
That's what he looked it up and found out that the reason they're offering him so much money is it's bigger than the one that you and I know about between Midland and Lubbock.
Have they released that yet, or is that still private knowledge?
I don't know. He didn't tell me. So, but I was in shock. And I go, really? It's between New Mexico and down there.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, and he was excited because they'd offered him all that money. And then he found out why they wanted to buy his place.
Yeah.
Because they think there's all... his is one of those that's got that huge, huge amount of oil under it.
Huh. I hadn't heard that yet.
Yeah, and he did not sell out.
Wow.
So he thinks that he will, you know, have a huge, huge, huge return, let me tell you.
Boy, I hope they do find that. I mean, man, that could really turn things around if that ends up being true.
Well, I mean, what they told him, it was true. But I don't know it, and I haven't verified it.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. I didn't think that they could find another one bigger than the previous one.
I didn't either, and we need to look that up. Somebody will have a record of it.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's got to be out there somewhere. So
aside
from having all this land that you can sell for a fortune, you know, at your fingertips, you know, people need to start doing something. People need to get into this place where, okay, we've got to grow some money. We've got to do things conservatively because we all know what Wall Street is like these days. And I know that, you know, things are up, they're down, and there's talk about, you know, recession. There's these rumors that are maybe a little bit more than rumors. I don't know. However, I would think, and you would probably know better, I would think that people are a little bit nervous about that. You know, people who have, like, all their eggs in one basket on Wall Street, are they getting nervous? Are they looking for alternatives?
We know they are because they're coming to me. Mm-hmm. This next week, I have appointments, already a couple appointments with people that have, you know, quite a bit of money that want to get diversified. They don't want to stay just in the stock market. And they're wanting to get out of what they're in now and get into something that's a little easier. You know, this is easy to do. You don't have to manage it. It's not like when you're in the stock market, you're managing that because you're looking every night to see, did I make money today? Did I lose? What's going on? And you're not in control of your destiny. You know, someone else controls every dime of your money. A lot of people don't think about that. But they don't control $1 of it. Whatever the broker says goes. And whatever he puts you in, that's where you are. So this is a little bit different because you know where your money is every day. You can't go down. And you know that whatever you're supposed to get, you will. The insurance company is not going to discount your money. That's what I love. Mm-hmm. The insurance company is going to pay you the face amount of that policy. They're not going to ask you to take a discount.
Let me ask you a two-part question. And
okay.
I feel like I know the answer, but I kind of want to hear it out loud just to make sure I'm looking at this the right way. You're talking about, you know, brokers on Wall Street and how you're in whatever they put you in. Is there a case at all, maybe very common, I don't know, but is there a case where, say, your broker on Wall Street may have their own personal interest, which may be counterproductive to an investor's goals? You know what I mean? So they may have some kind of interest in something else personally. Maybe they can benefit from something if they invest so much in company X or whatever it is, and it may not suit the investor's goals. Is that reasonable?
I think sometimes they're looking at the picture for themselves more than they are for the client. They're saying, you know, I need to sell this much mutual funds this week in this particular company. I need to sell a stock over here. We represent this company. You know, we're one of the leaders for them. We need to get some of that stock sold. And, you know, I need to get out front and do that.
Yeah, quotas,
goals. I think sometimes that happens. You know, they have to have the brokerage houses gives them a goal every week. This is a goal you must meet to stay here. Mm-hmm. You've got to sell so much of mutual funds, so much of stocks. People don't realize they have quota requirements that they must fulfill.
Yeah.
And in New York especially, all of those tell them you've got to do this much. You've got to make so many calls. You've got to talk to so many people. And that's the way it is. That's the rules.
I mean, it's pretty much a glorified sales position.
Yes, it is. And the ones that are really good, you know, they know who they can call on Monday morning and say, you know, I need to talk to you about this stock, and they'll usually buy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them don't even have to ask them. They have the authority to just, if they want to put them in it, they do it, and they take $1 million or $100,000 or whatever and buy those stocks. And they don't have to even ask you. Then there's some that are looking for new customers every day to get into a stock or to buy mutual funds. And, of course, bonds, I guess, are going to be on their way out. I never heard of such. You know, bonds are so low, you couldn't make a dime with a bond.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd live to see that.
I know. You've been saying how bonds are not what they used to be. And not only are they not making money, but now they're losing money.
Yeah, for the first time. And look at the Fed. Did you ever think you'd see interest rates this low in your lifetime?
No, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, and now mortgage loans have come down, and they're talking about, what if you bought a mortgage with zero interest? I can't imagine that in my lifetime. They're saying, what if?
Wow.
Can you imagine if you bought a mortgage and it's zero?
I mean, it's almost like what's down or what used to be down is now up, and what's up is now down. It's almost like the whole thing has changed. It's all backwards now. There's things that don't make any sense to people.
It is. And I think they need to get the interest rates up, way up. And, you know, I think everybody be tickled to death. You know, it's interest rates have been staying at 1.5-2%. Well, nobody's going to do that if they're not out of their mind.
Yeah.
Why would you go and get a CD at 2%? Anything we have will beat that. I mean, there isn't anything that isn't going to beat that.
So,
I mean, I don't know of anything.
So if you've got a broker on Wall Street and they're essentially investing in whatever they need to, you know, if they have a quota they need to meet, or if they have, you know, promises to X person, or whatever the case is, and it's not always in the investor's best interest, why are people going on? I mean, I can see why people are looking for other types of investments, because with a life settlement, the program you're talking about, people are in complete control of their own investment. They know everything. They sign on. They're in. They're out. You know, whatever they want to do, they are in complete control, right? I mean, that I would think that would be one of the biggest differences between a Wall Street investment and a life settlement, is people are in control.
I think that's the big thing. You control your destiny. You pick the policies you want to go in. You pick everything about this investment. And you know when the investment will end. You know what you're going to make. You know what your exposure is. What your liability is. You know all that up front. And that's the way it ought to be. You know everything there is to know. Whatever I know, you're going to know.
Yeah.
And so that's the way to invest.
And people even know how much they're going to make, give or take, when the policy matures.
That's exactly right. So when you sign, what used to be page 14, we don't know what page it is now. When you sign that, it tells you who the person is, what life insurance company carries the paper, how much you're going to make, what percentage. If it goes over, it tells you what it'll cost you, and you know everything about it. You know what kind of cancer they've got going in. And you know if it's an 18-month, a 30-month, 36-month, or 24. You know all of that. And then you know how much you're going to make. Now, and we've talked about this last week just very, very briefly. As you know, we've been taking reservations this week for this new policy that's going to pay 42%. It's going to pay 4 extra percentage points.
Wow.
We've never done that. And, it's a great policy. We've been taking reservations all week. We've still got a few reservations left that we can take. But this next week, we're going to close that thing out. So everybody's saying that's going to make 42% when it comes due. And it's not a 42-month. So this is, you know, I think it's great news. I think everybody's going to love it.
That's a big deal right there.
And I had three people last Monday morning who called and said, "Faye, I was listening Saturday, put me in for 100. One said, put me in for 150. So, you know, I did get a few people's attention with that.
I would assume so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we're going to close that out this next week. But it's going to be a great policy. This was a $3 million policy. We bought it for $1,550,000.
Holy smokes, that's a big profit margin.
It is. The people are going to make almost $1 million profit on this policy.
Wow.
Yes.
And that's what gets people's attention right there, is those profit margins. And how long is the policy?
Well, really, I'm doing 36 months, but it's really about 24. I had two opinions on it, and I just put them together. I did a blend. And so I blended it out to 36, but I think it's really a 24-month. And so I think it'll be an interesting proposition. I think it'll be a great deal, and I think everybody's going to want to get in it.
You know, just doing some basic math in my head, it's like, you know, that kind of profit in 24 months, give or take, for virtually doing nothing, it's a matter of saying, yes, I want in the policy. And then at that point, you just sit back and relax and wait for it to mature. I mean, so your involvement is relatively small, if not nothing. You know, it seems like those kinds of profits are too big to ignore with this entire type of investment.
We probably won't ever have this happen again. because we've never been able to buy a policy for 50 cents on the dollar. Never.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's where I think a lot, because I guess the biggest question people ask me during the week is I don't understand how a life insurance policy becomes an investment where we can make a big profit. And so for that type of person, you could probably explain, and you kind of touched on it there, you know, with buying this particular policy at 50 cents on the dollar, and they're not all like that. So where does the profit margin normally come from in a policy?
Okay, it comes from the difference of what we paid for it and what the face amount is. Okay? Like with the one we were just talking about. We paid $1,550,000. The face amount is $3 million. That's where you get your profit.
Okay.
Okay?
What would a normal policy roughly, and I know it changes for each one, but generally speaking, how much do you normally pay on it, percentage-wise?
Well, I think probably 70-74%.
Okay, so still really a really large profit margin.
Yeah, I think they have it's 1% a month usually for every month they've got it.
Okay.
So if it's 24 months, they're going to make 24%. And we've never been able to buy anything this cheap. It's just that the family really needs the money and they're in bad shape. And so they wanted to get it, and they agreed to do it, which, you know, we told them, you know, this is all we can pay, and they agreed to it. And we've never been able to buy a policy like that. I mean, it's usually very tight as to what we can make, you know. And usually getting that 1% a month is all we can ever manage. And this one, we got an extra 4% on there.
Does this kind of make you wonder, even if just in the back of your mind someplace, that at some point, if somebody really needs to sell a policy, maybe, you know, bidding like this, you know, again at some point in the future, is that an option, or is this really just a one-time thing?
I would doubt we would ever be able to do it again. I would love it every week if we could. But remember, our competition is fierce. We have a huge onslaught of other people who do this. So, you know, it's not easy. If it was easy, everybody would do it.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell people that. So, no, I don't think it's going to become a norm that you can bid that low and that people could make that much money. No, I don't. I think we're doing good to get the 1% a month.
Yeah. Yeah, and that seems to be the way a lot of your investors like it, because, I mean, they get involved with these things, and yes, the profit margins are large, but it also seems like the way that you normally bid these policies, it seems like the payout and the return comes a whole lot quicker. People aren't waiting 5, 7, 10 years for an investment to come due. It's anywhere from, what, 18 to 30 months on average?
Yeah, on an average it is. I usually average it out about 22, 24 months on an average. And it can go 36, or it can be, you know, 18 months. Because we're bidding all the time on all of them. And, of course, you know, we did three big policies this last week. And they were $1 million policies. And they were pancreatic cancer. And on that one, the man was back in the hospital, and we were worried that if we didn't get it done, they might rescind it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was. We were cutting that one a little bit close.
Is that one a done deal?
I think it's a done deal.
Okay, all right, cool.
Yeah, but anyway, the one we were talking about a minute ago, it's going to pay the 42%. No, I don't think that would ever happen again. If it does, I will be in shock. I've always wanted to buy one for that price, but never was able to.
Mm-hmm.
And these people agreed to it because they were so ill. And usually you've got their brokers working against you at all times. And this guy did not have a broker representing him. He came to us direct.
Really?
Yes. And if he'd had some brokers, those brokers would have helped out to where we would have just barely inked it out, you know?
Wow.
Yes.
And how long is this policy?
Okay. It should be between 24 and 30-something.
Okay.
But we're paying that extra money on it.
So that's about when people can expect to get paid, and that's really the whole concept behind this whole thing. It's not that, you know, people come in, they should not expect to, hey, I'm gonna invest in a policy and then I'm gonna make, you know, tons of money and I'm gonna retire and I'm in for one and done and out. The way this whole thing works is that it's part of a plan. It's a long term plan. It's a multiple year type of thing. You know, so people should expect to be in this type of investment or the program, multiple investments at the same time if possible. And so how long should people expect to be in policies before they are almost ready for retirement or in good shape or better shape? About how long does that take in general?
About 7 years if it's a normal deal, because you'll have some come in early. We're going to book that and redo it and put it back in policies. We're going to have some that will come in right on time within a month. Then we're going to have stragglers that are going to come in late. So you have to allow for all that, and it takes several years. You know, lots of times the first ones will come in early, the next one's on time, then you may have three or four that are late, and you have to wait for those to come in and redo those. So if you just keep doing this, you will make money, and it'll work out. It's a law of averages on this.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to figure at all times.
And so when people are doing this, and I know this is the first thing that they're going to ask. I'm assuming when they come to your office, it also is the first thing they ask. I'm sure they say, Faye, how much can I make and how fast can I make it?
Usually how much can I make, not how fast. Usually they're not, you know, they're pretty relaxed because it's IRAs. Usually IRAs. And they'll say, you know, how much can I make? How do I get paid? They want to know, how does it work? How do I get paid? And I explain to them that the bank handles it. The bank pays the premiums. When the people pass away, the bank gets the check, puts it in everybody's account. And I explain all that. And, you know, how long it takes to get paid after, you know, a policy matures. We've got three or four right now that are fixing to go into people's banks. We're waiting on those checks. And that's, you know, that's the way it works on a continual basis.
So it's a very fast, simple process. Really, the whole thing is streamlined. It's all mapped out. You're in. You wait for the policy mature. When it does, you get paid. And then most people turn around, take that profit, reinvest in another policy or two or three or whatever it takes.
That's exactly right. And I had a guy call this last week. He said, I want to do it. I want to put a couple hundred thousand. I said, are you accredited? You must be accredited. He said, well, I don't know. He said, I think I'm worth about $900,000. I said, you need to go home and add it up and see what you have. But people forget they've got a 401k, they have an IRA, they have ranches, they have rentals. I've got a lot of people with that own a lot of houses. You know, there's so many things they can consider and put in this. They can put cattle. There's all kinds of things. Your equipment on the ranch. Add it all up and see what you have.
Do you find that a lot of people, because I know that people are running through some numbers right now and they're thinking, oh, you know, this is a really great opportunity to make some money here. And they're probably running through general numbers. They may be driving around and not have access to all their records, but they're kind of doing some rough math in their head. Do you find that people who may be close, but they don't think that they're actually there, forget about things, and in reality, they're well over the requirements?
We had the people from Big Spring several months ago did not think they were qualified. They were afraid they weren't. And 2 months later, I heard from them, and they were worth over $1 million. They were worth $1.5 million.
Hmm. Well, now that's pretty significant. So that's a big difference.
It is a big difference. And lots of times they have to go look up the value of things. They may have to look up the value of the ranch, the value of their rent homes, you know, what their income is off of. They have to look all this up. So a lot of times they have to go home and figure that out. Then some people know, because of their income tax, you know, what all their holdings are worth.
Mm-hmm. We should probably mention what it means to be accredited, because, you know, we kind of touched on it. There are some basic requirements to be involved in a life settlement. So what does it actually mean to be accredited?
Okay, you must make $200,000 a year, or if you don't, you must be worth $1 million without your home.
All right.
You cannot consider the home, because in Texas, And a lot of other places, the government doesn't allow that.
Are there any changes? Does the dynamic change at all between like a single investor or a double investor or anything like that?
No. Well, now if it's a husband and wife, and they're gonna, if it's a joint account and they're both gonna invest, they must make $300,000 together.
Okay.
Yes, if it's that type of deal. But if it's just an IRA for the husband or the wife, either one, it's $200,000 or that jointly they must be worth $1 million.
Now, these people from Big Spring that you were talking about, can I ask, without getting, you know, any kind of specifics here, can I ask what was it that made the difference? What is it that pushed them over the line that they weren't sure would get them there?
Well, they had to go back and look up their brokerage accounts and see what their investments were really worth.
Mm. Okay.
Because when they came to see me, they were just putting it on paper. I think it's worth this, and I think it's worth that.
Okay, so they were guessing at first.
They were guessing, and so they went home, looked everything up, their 401k, their other investments, and it was over.
Okay. Significantly over, too, I'll say that.
Yes, it was. It was significant. They had more money than they thought because she was sitting there adding it up, and they said, well, I think it's worth, you know, $700,000 to $800,000. And, well, we knew they didn't have enough because his yearly income was not $200,000. It was about $160,000. So once they added up, they knew they were right. They had it.
Wow.
So they came back, and they are now a client.
So they were estimating themselves roughly about half of what they were actually worth.
That's right. That's one of the few times that's happened. Most people are pretty close, you know, about what they're worth. But this couple was not. I guess they hadn't redone it in years.
Okay. And for those who are not accredited, there are some other options. We'll get into that here in just a little bit. We'll also get into the risks, because I know that there are three major risks. People need to know about those going in. You know, we've talked about how wonderful the program is, how much money people can make, how this makes, you know, for a great retirement plan. We'll get into all those here in just a little bit. But for right now, this is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring, right next to Ivy Cottage.
Now, every Saturday morning, we get into trivia, and we talk about all kinds of different things. Sometimes you talk about you know, places to visit in Texas or a place to put on your bucket list or some history. So what's our topic this morning?
Roy Orbison, the greatest singer, I guess, one of the greatest singers there ever were.
Yeah, I would agree with that, absolutely.
Oh, my gosh, he was good. And some of the things that nobody knows about him, you know, he wore the dark glasses all the time, and everybody thought he was blind.
Yeah.
And that's not true at all. One day when he was on stage, or fixing to go on stage, he couldn't find his glasses. He'd taken them off, and he had his sunglasses there. He put them on, and from then on, he wore sunglasses every performance. He said it really helped his eyes, and he did a better job. Can you imagine?
You know, I've heard performers say that those lights are so bright in their eyes that, you know, either a hat or a sunglasses or something helps keep that brightness out.
That's right. And everybody always wondered why he stood so still.
Yeah.
And he said, it's the only way I can do it. He said, I never learned to sing any other way. And he started singing at 8 years of age.
Wow.
And the things people have said over the years about his voice is just amazing. I mean, from Elvis Presley, it doesn't matter who it was, they all thought he was one of the most gifted singers of our time.
Yeah.
And he almost had an operatic voice. He could hit a high note that nobody else could hit. And the story goes, he was trying to do this song, and they'd already done it over twice, and he just wasn't getting it. And they put him in a closet and had him do that song in a closet. And he reached that high note.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I've never heard that story. That's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. Now, he was born in Vernon, Texas.
Hmm.
His dad was an oil well driller. And, you know, his one thing about it, you know, he was from, his family was from the old country. And one of his ancestors was Thomas Orbison, 1715, came from Ulster, North Ireland.
Ooh.
Yeah, settled in Pennsylvania Colony in the 18th century. That's how far back his family goes.
Wow.
Yes. And so they moved to Wink, and, you know, with the football, the oil fields, the grease, he said, and the sand.
The sand.
So, you know, we know what he's talking about, don't we? But he used real thick glasses from an early age. They say he was very quiet, polite, but he was keen on singing, and his dad gave him that guitar on his 6th birthday.
Wow.
Yes. And he had no idea at that time that music was going to be his life. And, you know, he started singing in high school. And, you know, him and his friends had a little band. And they were just, you know, they thought they were doing pretty good and singing. And they were on television. Shoot, in early age, he had his own show. And he played on several stations in Midland and Odessa.
Did he really?
And him and his little friends, you know, were doing all this stuff. And he went to North Texas University, and he was going to study geology. And he thought he would come back out here, you know, and go in the oil fields. That's what he thought he was going to do. And, of course, he met Pat Boone while he was at North Texas. And he said, well, my gosh, if he can get a recording contract, surely I can get one. And that changed his life because he said, you know, I think I can make a living. But, of course, he was getting $400 to play at dances. And after graduating from Wink, you know, he didn't know what he was going to do. But while there, they heard a song called Obie Dobie. And they loved it. They were always singing that out there with his little band. Then he enrolled in Odessa Junior College. And he played on KMID in Midland. And it was called the Wink Westerners. And they kept doing this, playing dances on weekend. And then while he was performing and living in Odessa, he saw Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash because they were touring out then. And they suggested that he approach Sam Phillips at Sun Records.
Oh.
And Phillips was nasty to him. He said, well, you know, I make my own decisions. So they were rejected. And so in 1950, they recorded Obie Dobie. And they sent him a copy, and he offered them a record recording at that time. So they went on to Sun Records in Memphis. And again, that's the only song they had. And it broke the billboards on the Hot 100, and that was in 1956. And it peaked at number 56. It sold 200,000 copies.
Holy smokes!
Yeah. And he said, we were doing everything we could to get applause. We only had one hit record. And he was writing songs in rockabilly style, and he wrote Go, 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 Rock House. And then they finally split up. They had differences. And if you remember the story, he had a 16-year-old girlfriend named Claudette Frady. And so she joined him in Memphis. And he wrote a song called The Clown. And everybody heard it. They said, well, you'll never make it in this profession. That song is so bad. And so he started writing music for some other people. And he only got paid on one song at Sun Records. That was just the way it was. And he was in awe of Chet Atkins. And he heard him, and he said, you know, I think I can do this. And so he was writing music at night in his car.
Really?
And because he had, but this time he had a little boy and had a wife. And it was too noisy, and you know he was having to go out in the car and write music.
So they had some peace and quiet in the house.
Yeah, where he could have peace and quiet. So his first two songs, of course, was Crying, and it reached number two. And so they were doing pretty good. And so then he wrote How Long Must I Dream? And that got him really on the charts. And so he did good on that. But his song, A Pretty Woman, you remember that song.
Oh yeah.
And that's everybody says it's one of the greatest songs ever written was Pretty Woman. And the story behind Pretty Woman is that his wife was going to go out shopping, and him and his partner were sitting there working on some songs, and he asked his wife, he said, "Do you need some money?" And his partner said, "A pretty woman never needs any money." And they sat down and wrote that song.
Really?
They sat down and wrote it right then.
Wow. I've never heard that story before. I had no idea where it came from.
And then when he did Only the Lonely, that became his trademark sound of the way he did that. They said it was a new strategy. Instead of mixing it from the top down, they did it from the bottom up. And that changed the way he sounds, and that's what made him really so famous. And Only the Lonely went to number 2 on the billboards, and it hit number 1, and that was what really made him, and that's when he really got started. And, of course, you know, he did Blue Angel. He did I Can't Stop Loving You. And a lot of these were really my favorites that he did. And a lot of people wrote all kinds of stories about him. And some of them said they had one of the most beautiful voices they'd ever heard. And some of them was like Elvis Presley and all these other people, you know, wrote all these stories about how he sounded. And Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel both said, you know, it was like the cry of an angel falling backward through an open window. And when they heard crying for the first time, they said, to me, it was like the voice of God. And Elvis Presley said his voice was the greatest and most distinctive he ever heard.
Wow. And that's a big compliment from the king.
Yeah, and it was compared to opera by Bob Dylan. And everybody said, you didn't know if you were listening to opera or mariachi.
Wow.
He kept you on your toes. Said it was like his compositions in 3 or 4 octaves that made you want to drive your car over a cliff. Yeah. Said he had the voice that you've never heard. And he was touring. And this one song, when he sang it, the audience just went completely silent. He was doing Indian Love Song, and the audience just went completely silent in awe of his voice.
Wow.
Yeah. And they said, his love, his life, the whole world, you know, not with a whimper, but a beautiful bang. And I think it's because he had, you know, he could go so high and he could go so low, and the way he sang just made people want to just stop in their tracks and listen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and he was very shy. And that was another thing. The glasses helped him with his shyness.
You know, it's like he's got the whole thing. He had this image that he just kind of stumbled on, you know, because of a couple of different circumstances. And then, you know, his voice, like everybody says, it's so unique. And I see it now because, you know, he has that vibrato in it. And so, you know, he can hit those high notes. So it does. It makes all the sense in the world when they start talking about how, you know, being semi-op, you know, opera-like. I get what they're saying now. It's that vibrato thing, especially when he hits higher notes, you know, and it's all controlled. It's not anything that's, you know, he's like struggling to hit a note and, you know, he just kind of hits it and then goes off and then hits it and goes off. No, it's all complete vocal control. It really is amazing, some of the comparisons that people have made.
It really is. And, you know, when he recorded Pretty Woman, it was amazing how many people were on the set. You know, when I think about this, when he recorded Pretty Woman, it was amazing how big the band was. He had Billy Stanford, Jerry Kennedy, Wayne Moss, Floyd Kramer, who's one of my favorite on the piano, Bob Moore, Boots Randolph,
and
Charlie McCoy were on sax.
Wow.
And then he had 2 other guys on drums. I mean, I can't even imagine assembling this good of an orchestra to record a song.
I know. Wow, that's amazing. I didn't realize Boots. I mean, I remember Boots Randolph from like Yakety Sax and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I didn't realize he was with Roy Orbison.
Yeah, and Floyd Kramer, one of the greatest pianists there ever was playing the piano for him on that song.
Wow.
Yeah, and when I think back, because I love all of his music, and I was just thinking about him the other day, and I said, you know, we need to do a story about them. And he can just hit the biggest notes imaginable and still sound unspeakably sad. They said it all the time.
Yeah, now that's true. He does have that sad kind of quality, that melancholy tone in his voice.
And somebody asked him about loneliness in his songs. And he said, I don't think I'm any more lonely than anybody else. He said, although, if you grew up in West Texas, there are a lot of ways to be lonely.
Oh, wow.
So it tells you a lot about where he grew up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It sounds like he not only was a great guy, but he had a great sense of humor, too, is what it sounds like.
That's right. And, you know, you and I wouldn't even think about all the things, you know, growing up in that small town and then coming to West Texas and, you know, football and music. That's all you had.
You know, you were talking about how he was, you know, over there at Sun Records in Memphis. Have you ever been up to the Sun Records place?
No, I haven't.
You should go. They've got the picture there of the of Roy Orbison when he, what do they call it, the Million Dollar Quartet, and they're all standing there, you know, in Sun's studio in the recording. It's one room is all it is. So it's not like it's a long, complicated thing. But they got him in the Million Dollar Quartet, and that huge you know, iconic picture is hanging there, and you can stand right where he and Elvis and all of them were when they were recording those things. It's really a magical place to visit.
Well, and you know, Elvis had him go pick up one of his girlfriends in his purple Cadillac once also. You know, once he got to Nashville, you know, he became very well acquainted with all the guys, kind of like the Rat Pack. And but he didn't make any money till he went to RCA.
Yeah.
And when he went to RCA, that's where he really made his money. And, you know, they paid him. One of them paid him $1 million for a contract.
That's a lot back then.
But he got a bad manager, and that's when things started falling apart.
Yep.
But up till then, he was doing good. And then he was out of recording for a while, and then he went back. And, of course, he had a bad heart, and that's, you know, what really killed him.
Yeah.
But he recorded so many great hits. It's just amazing. That, you know, how many hits he really had.
Yeah, yeah. Not only hits that he recorded, but then there were so many remakes. And then, you know, he went on to, he was part of the Traveling Wilburys, I think, in the
That's right, the Wilburys. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so.
And he traveled with them for a while. But his songs were just legendary. Like you said, there was a lot of re-recordings of his songs. And I think Elvis recorded some of them, didn't he?
I think so, yeah.
And I know a lot of people did because they loved his music and that style he had. But I think it was a lot different. I think the things he recorded are things I really remember because Only the Lonely always got to me. I thought that was such a great song.
Yeah.
And some of the others, Blue Bayou, that's another one that I thought was just great.
Oh, yeah.
And you remember Maxine?
I don't know that I remember. Wait a minute.
Maxine? That was a funny thing.
I do now. And, you know, no matter, with all the remakes that people have done and of Roy Orbison songs, they still don't sound like Roy Orbison. You still hear, even when somebody else does a Roy Orbison song, in your mind, you still hear the Roy Orbison flair, you know, that he put on these songs. And so, even if it's somebody else's voice, you still hear Roy Orbison coming through. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody could do Careless Heart like he did.
Oh, God, no.
I just don't think they can do that one.
No.
Because that's just too different.
Yeah.
You know? But I wish we still had him around because he was one of the greatest singers there were.
Oh, yeah, that's the truth right there. That's no doubt.
and coming from a little bitty town and, you know, having his little band here in Midland, Odessa, and playing on the, just playing on the TV. You know, he had a little show, and, I mean, even as shy as he was, he did all that.
You know, I guess I didn't realize he had spent so much time on stages here in West Texas. That's pretty cool.
He did. I mean, there was three television stations he was on.
Wow.
And he started on TV. I don't know if it was ever Saturday or not, but when he was eight, he had his own little show.
Wow.
When he was 8 years old.
That's amazing. That's just...
And his dad taught him to play guitar.
Yeah. And what did he give him to? He gave him his guitar at six?
At six, he got the guitar, and by eight, he was on television. I mean, you know. And his voice was so, and I don't know how good it was at eight. It had been good.
I don't know anybody else who was well-established in their career at 8 years old. That's few and far between.
And I don't know how much they paid him at eight, but he was playing, had his own little show. They'd bring him on.
Yeah.
And then they're in high school. Him and the other boys, you know, started their little band, and they were playing at dances. They were getting $400. But, you know, he went to college because he thought he might have to come back to the oil fields in West Texas.
Yeah, that was the plan.
And, then he met Pat Boone over there at North Texas, probably the 1 o'clock lab band.
Yep.
And when he found out that Pat Boone had got a record contract, he said, "Well, if he can do it, I think I can."
That's still funny.
And Oobie Doobie, and I don't even remember that one, but that was his first song ever.
Wow.
And they recorded it. And old Sun Records didn't think it was good enough. They sent him a copy, and then they got a contract. And then when he did The Clown, they said, "This guy will never go anywhere." It must have been bad. I don't know what it sounded like. I've never heard that one.
Yeah, I don't know. It must have been pretty bad, but... Then again, you never know. It's so cool that such an icon in music, a musical legend, has such ties to West Texas. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, he really was a true West Texan and got his start right here.
Nice. Great information about Roy Orbison. This is Your Money with Faye Bagby. Your phone number is?
It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. 3330, and we're at 3105 Big Spring, right down the street from Walgreens. How about that?
what did you call it earlier? America's Main Street or something?
It is. We are on Main Street.
No, we're talking about the program for life settlements, and we're talking about how people can invest in a life insurance policy. And we were talking about how wonderful it is, how it's a conservative investment. People know what they're going to make. They know also what the risks are going in, so it's not like anybody's going to get hit with any surprises. There are three main risks going in to a life settlement. So what are they?
Okay, the first risk, and this is the main risk, is the policy could go over, and you might have to pay premiums. So you need to know that going in up front. If you can't afford $1,000 or $2,000 in premium, it's not for you. That's why you must be accredited to do this, because our accredited people do have the money, and it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing right there. The other one is, remember, it's not liquid during the time it's invested. Now, each time the investment finishes up, yes, it's liquid. So at that time, it's liquid if you need some money. But most of these are IRAs, and people don't need that because they're trying to get to retirement with their IRA. So then we have the insurance companies. If an insurance company ever went under, we have the Texas Guarantee Fund. We've never had to use it. We've never had a life insurance company go under in Texas. And all the ones we use are A and AA ready. They're huge life insurance companies.
So really, although it's a risk, and you tell people about it, they know it going in, it's almost like even if that were to happen, there's almost like a plan B and a plan C and a plan D in place.
Yes, there is a B and C in place.
All right. So it's not something that people have to worry about all that much, but it's nice that they know it going in. So for those... you know, people are looking at this and saying, okay, well, I'm not exactly accredited yet. You know, I'm still hoping to get there. I still know that I need to plan for retirement. I need to do something. So aside from a life settlement, if somebody is not accredited, there are some other options too. People shouldn't just say, well, geez, I'm not accredited, so I'm just going to work until, you know, my fingers fall off. No, there are other options that they can pursue.
That's right. They can do an annuity. Now, someone heard me on the radio last week and got the wrong impression. I want to correct that.
Uh-oh.
They thought I said that you could invest $20,000 to $50,000 and take it out in 2 years. I didn't say that, I hope. If I did, I sure didn't mean to say it, and I don't think I did. As you know, the contracts are 10 years. What I said was, if you have an emergency, you can take your money out in 3 years, okay? It's not that you can just take it out in 2 years because you would lose your interest. They would charge you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, you cannot do that. It's a 10-year contract or a 7-year contract, and if you have an emergency, you can take it out at the end of the 3rd year. That's what I said.
Okay.
And right. Annuities are guaranteed by the assets of a life insurance company. So we use the very biggest life insurance companies. They pay very well. They're going to pay like 6%, 7%, 8%. It varies every year. But once you get the interest, it's locked in. It can never go down. That's what the good thing about an annuity. It is also a retirement vehicle. And someone said something about it, and I need to check. But he didn't find a lot of information on our website about annuities. And I thought it was there, so I need to check that.
All right.
Maybe I didn't have as much as he wanted, okay?
Okay.
But annuities have been around for 150 years. They're old time. And they're still doing annuities, so you know they're still doing the right thing. And it's for people that can't qualify for the other, but they want a good, safe investment that's conservative. This is the most conservative investment that we have. Is an annuity.
So if somebody's not accredited, they're really interested in the life settlement, but they're not accredited, would it make sense to grow their wealth through annuities, build up to get accredited, and then start the program then? Would that make any sense?
That's right. Sure, that's what I would do.
Okay.
I would grow it in an annuity till it's time and then switch it over.
Okay.
And we're not saying you can't invest, we're just saying you cannot invest in a life settlement if you're not qualified.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do an annuity because you don't have to be worth as much. You still have to have income, and we still have to check your income and your liabilities and all that to qualify you. But it's not as hard to qualify as it is for the other.
Yeah, there are still requirements and people have to meet them, but they're a little bit easier to attain for somebody who's not to that accredited stage yet. So for somebody who's looking at this and they're saying, okay, this is really great. We've talked a lot, many times about how, you know, it's never really too late. I mean, obviously, if you're like 80, you know, it's too late to start a life settlement. But what about requirements for, you know, like an annuity? Is there any age that's too late to start something like that?
Yes, they won't take you after like 76.
Mm. Okay.
Yes, they do not. They will not do that.
Okay. So there's a number of options, and people need to just really explore. And you talk all the time about how people procrastinate and they put things off. Do you think that there is typically a trigger event to get people started, or do they just hear you and they say, you know, this makes just too much sense? There's so little effort, and you can make so much money. Let's just get the ball rolling. Is that
true? Yes, I think so. And then I have a lot of people that are talking to these people all the time. I had some people call this last week, and one of our clients had talked to them, said, you need to talk to Faye. And so they've made appointments, and they're coming this next week.
Okay.
So that does happen a lot. And the other thing is, you know, if people keep a lot of cash in their account, they're not making money.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making 2%, you're not making anything. So I would say get out of their comfort zone and, you know, talk to me and see if they like it, if they like us, and if it works for them. Because, you know, it's a conservative investment.
Okay.
And it's not wild and rocky like Wall Street. If you're a conservative person, this might be a good fit for you.
Yeah, it seems like most people, once they get started and used to the process, it's really an easy ride, and they love it, you know, going forward. It seems like a win-win for everybody. So do you have any appointments available this coming week?
Yes, Wednesday afternoon and Thursday and Friday morning.
Okay. So, Faye, one last time, what's your phone number so people can call and make an appointment to come see you?
Okay. It's 877-588-3330. That's 877-588-3330. And we're at 3105 Big Spring, right on Main Street.
You've been listening to Your Money with Faye Bagby, sound advice to help your money grow. Listen for Your Money with Faye Bagby every Saturday morning at 10 here on 97 Gold.
This program has been a paid presentation for American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC, and has been brought to you by American Financial and Retirement Services, LLC. The opinions expressed on the program by the host, host guest, and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not represent the opinions of management of this station or Brazos Communications West, LLC, who bear no responsibility or liability for the program's content. The purpose of this radio program is intended to inform the public on financial planning issues and investment products for qualified individuals and investors. Many of the topics and opinions discussed may be of a personal nature, and some people may disagree with or find opinions expressed on this program objectionable. Before you invest, you should consult with financial advisors and review the program prospectus and its risks.